Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Monday morning. It is very nice to have you with us on this 15th day of March. It is 12 minutes past 9 o'clock and a thrill to have you here. We have a lot to discuss. We have many wonderful people to do it with, and we welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. All right, let us go to the group here and introduce everybody, and we'll get started. WAMC's Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, sir. How are you? Good to see you.
Good morning. Here we are in the WAMC studios, and I have to say, it's cold outside. Very, very cold.
The 13 degrees on my car thermometer.
And that's before the wind starts blowing.
Yeah, that's right.
And that will...
Especially when I started like driving fast.
Yeah, that'll do you in. That would do you in. I want to take a moment to thank the wonderful people who sent me sippy cups. These giant, beautiful aluminum sippy cups.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Very nice.
It was very nice of you, and I do appreciate it. Mm-hmm.
Good. Excellent. Good morning, Alan. All right. Mm-hmm. Jennifer Burns is here, U Albany lecturer in Africana Studies. Good morning, Jennifer. How are you?
Good morning, everyone. I'm good. Glad to be here.
Wonderful to have you here. Thank you. Always good to have you here. And we also welcome political consultant and lobbyist Libby Post. Good morning, Libby. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. I'm just ducky. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you very much. Very nice to have you here. And Albany Law School professor and director of the Immigration Law Clinic at Albany Law School. Now, is that true? Is it the Albany, the Immigration Law Clinic is at the Albany Law School. Am I right on that?
That's a fact.
That's a fact, Jack.
Okay. I thought so. I just realized that I was kind of riffing there because I had the script away from my eyes. So I wanted to make sure it was actually accurate. Okay, good. Jennifer, Sarah Rogerson, good morning. Thank you.
Good morning.
Good to have you with us. You know, the music we played coming in, I just want to mention this real quick, is from the Albany Symphony Orchestra. It is selections from Christopher Theofanides, who our good friend David Allen Miller won a Grammy last night. So that is very cool. He now has his second Grammy.
That's great.
And this selections from Christopher Theofanides is the work that did it, and hopefully we're going to have David on later in the show. We're trying to get him on, and just congratulations to the entire Albany Symphony Orchestra, and especially to our good friend David Allen Miller, who we just love and adore.
And you know, Joe, I've thought for many years we are so lucky to have him. He's got us on the map, and you just worry that, you know, somebody like, you know, some minor league city like San Francisco or, you know, one of those places.
I think his heart's here.
I tell you, we are so lucky to have him.
He is.
And I just hope he stays with us.
He's a good dude. So hopefully we'll talk to him later. And yeah, by doing this, I'm sort of begging him. That's true. No question about it. Panel at WAMC.org is our email address. Let's get started. We'll talk about the issues of the day and find out what's happening. And it's, let's see, we'll begin with the story about vaccinations in New York State. Now, this was an exclusive story from the Washington Post. They broke this story where New York's vaccines are called county officials to gauge their loyalty to Cuomo amid sexual harassment investigation. Now, apparently this is sort of, now I'm extrapolating a little bit, but kind of how the call went is, hey, hi, I'm the vaccine czar, and I'm just checking in to you county officials, want to see how things are going. How do you feel about Governor Cuomo? What do you think he's going through? And oh, by the way, what kind of vaccines do you need? There you go. Something like that would be how it played out. One county executive was so unsettled by the outreach from Larry Schwartz, head of the state's vaccine rollout, that the executive on Friday filed notice of an impending ethics complaint with the public integrity unit of the state attorney general's office. The executive feared the county's vaccine supply could suffer if Schwartz was not pleased with the executive's response to his questions about support for the governor. The executive said the conversation with Schwartz came in proximity to a separate conversation with another Cuomo administration official about vaccine distribution. At best, it was inappropriate, said the executive, who spoke on the condition of anonymity out of the fear that the Cuomo administration would retaliate against the county's residents. At worst, it was clearly over the ethical line. Schwartz, who is working in a volunteer capacity to run New York's vaccine distribution, acknowledged making the calls in response to an inquiry by the Post, Washington Post, that is, but said he did so as a friend, 30-year friend of Cuomo, and did not discuss vaccines in the conversation. So, Alan, what do you think?
Well, first of all, Joe, I know Larry Schwartz. I used to work with him. And he's a political person. He's the kind of person that when you're in trouble, you want doing your work for you. Of that, there is no question. It was a mistake in my mind. It was the kind of thing you shouldn't do because it's always open to interpretation. And those interpretations certainly aren't always wrong. So if they had called me, I was thinking just this morning, Joe, about a wonderful man I know. I don't know if you remember him, named Drew Zambelli.
Oh, sure.
And Drew Zambelli was the best of the senior Cuomo and junior Cuomo advisors. And I don't think this would have happened if Drew Zambelli was there. He died at a very young age. Well, young for me, 70. And he was the kind of guy who was a PhD in psychology. When I would say something bad about Andrew, he would call me up and he'd keep me on the phone for quite a while. But he was always gentle and nice and smart. You know, this idea of taking a political person like Larry Schwartz and having him make the calls, somebody should have looked around that corner before you did something dumb like that.
Well, it is. Here's the issue is, Libby, from what I can tell, is that you don't have your vaccine guy call and ask county executives who are working on vaccine rollouts. I'm just saying this is the charge, but it doesn't seem to make sense. And then instead of talking about vaccines, which Larry Schwartz said I wasn't asking about, okay, but what you are asking about is, do you support the governor? So if you are a county executive and you are talking to the vaccine czar about your support for the governor, it seems like inevitably you would put two and two together.
You think?
Yes.
It's a little, what do they call that? Ham-handed? It's a little ham-handed. I think it's, I mean, I get where he's coming from. I understand wanting to protect the governor, you know, but the optics of all of this and perception is reality in politics. And and did they really think that no one was going to talk and say something to the media?
I mean, well, so I want to just parse.
Makes no sense.
Can I parse what you just said? Because I think, isn't there a difference? So if it was just a 30-year-old friend who happened to be the vaccine czar calling up and saying, oh, so what do you think about our friend Andrew Cuomo? Okay, that's one thing. But then to have that call followed up by another person to find out about vaccines, that's the issue too, right?
Well, yes, but... And if they wanted to do some calls about how are you feeling about the governor, it could have been somebody else.
Right.
And not the vaccine czar, where the lines are just too easily blurred and the message is too easily construed.
Jennifer
Burns.
I like it. Very direct and to the point. Jennifer Burns.
I agree.
Look at that, even more succinct. Did you want to add anything, or should I go to Sarah?
You should go to Sarah.
Okay, Sarah?
Yeah, I sat around these decision-making tables, not at the governor's level, of course. But, like, I was just trying to imagine the conversation among leadership, even if it was on a Zoom, right? So nobody's sitting around the table anymore these days. But looking at all the windows and saying, so... You know, who best to make this phone call? the person who's running the vaccination program would be the last person from just about every standpoint, including optics, which I imagine everyone is concerned about deeply at the moment, with everything that broke over the weekend in terms of federal officials uncharacteristically calling for the governor to step down. So I think we are seeing a tailspin, and this is indicative of that.
And remember, guys, that he used to, Larry Schwartz used to be secretary to the governor, the top,
right,
the top position. And, you know, he would get himself into a certain amount of trouble, and away he went. And now when Andrew needs somebody really tough and political, back he comes to do this work.
Well,
and by the way, has anybody heard much from Melissa DeRosa, the secretary to the governor, lately?
Well, that's the other thing too, is that one of the thoughts here, it doesn't make it right, but just is that he may have been the only guy left. From what we hear, people just aren't even showing up to work in the executive office. So I don't know, you know, how many people, to use Sarah's analogy, were actually sitting around the table, because I don't know that,
you know,
how many of them are left.
You know, Joe, Mario used to say to me, anybody, any politician can say, if you do this, I'll do this. But what you have to do is think six steps ahead. You mean to say, and this is Sarah's point, and I think it's our point, which is, you mean to say nobody sitting around that table could figure out what the repercussions were going to be?
Well, and also, it seems to me, and I'm not saying this is the case, but I am asking the question of, but what if that was the intent? To say, okay, you do this, or I mean, that is exactly the message you want to send.
One could certainly assume that was the intent.
And that's the issue, right? That's the overall issue.
You do this, and I'll throw a baseball through your window.
Right. So I like this unnamed county executive said, at best it was inappropriate, at worst it was clearly over the ethical line. But we can talk a lot about, you know, the governor's behavior and that ethical line, which I think a lot of people are trying to come to terms with. Larry Schwartz said, I did nothing wrong. I've always conducted myself in a manner commensurate to a high ethical standard. So I want to get to what Sarah said. You know, this is the latest story to come out of what's been happening with the governor and the calls for his resignation. And the big story to break late Friday or in the afternoon on Friday was first, and this was happening as our show was going on Friday morning, as the entire, most of the New York delegation, congressional delegation, called for the governor's resignation. And that was a coordinated effort to have most of the members say that he should resign. And then you have this extraordinary measure of both U.S. senators, Gillibrand and Schumer, come out and say they believe that he should resign. And then late last night, the president of the United States is getting off of the chopper, and they say, do you believe the governor should resign? And he says, I believe that we should wait and see what the investigation brings. So,
well, but Joe, the wait and see answer is a pro-Trump answer, if you think about it. I mean, that's what Trump, I keep doing that, what Cuomo wanted, obviously. Cuomo wants the investigation. I think the theory is by that time things will quiet down, and he'll be in better shape than he is right now, forced with all these resignation requests and everything. So that's what I think is happening. I think that that you could take both the president and the vice president saying that as something that would make Cuomo more comfortable.
Libby, do you think that it is possible? I mean, I certainly understand that would be the hope of the governor, that this just, you know, calms down and goes away. But boy, there is a lot of smoke and maybe even a lot of fire here for it to subside.
So, Libby, does he stay around? Does he quit or does he stay around?
I think there's a middle ground here, which is what John McDonald and Pat Fahey have suggests that he step aside and Kathy Hochul becomes acting governor, who I think is incredibly capable and can do the job. I don't think there's any question that Kathy can do this job. So I think that that's a middle ground to be taken for now. There's this part of me that's like, oh my God, you know, we have to believe what women say, and I do believe that. And then there's the other part of me that is like, well, we have to believe in the rule of law and due process, mm-hmm. and let the investigations play out. But the question remains whether or not, as many people have said, whether or not, the ability to govern is still there. Now, the One House bills for the budgets came out this weekend. The things that I was working on, were one was in, one was out, which is what I wanted. So the budget process is moving forward. But after the budget is done, and I think the governor really wants to have a hand in that. There was an article in the TU about this morning about how things are moving forward, marijuana and off-track betting, but sports betting, mm-hmm. online sports betting and that sort of stuff. But once the budget is done, and even maybe before that, I think that it's going to be difficult for him to continue to govern and be effective and do his job while these investigations are ongoing. And so, having him not resign, but step aside for a while until the investigation's done and let Kathy Hochul take the helm, I think is the most measured and most practical way forward for the state.
Now, my bet is that's not going to happen.
My bet is that that's not going to happen either. But Joe asked, what do I think should be done?
Oh, I thought so I'm asking the question, what do you think is going to happen? I think he's going to stay. I think he's going to hang in there. Whether he runs for governor again is going to be anybody's business. That would be questionable.
I want to play this forward a little bit, sure. and play it out and extrapolate. I know we don't like to predict things, but I would like to
do
that.
Oh, I do. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So good. So let's all get our crystal balls and shine them up. And we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll look into them and see what you think. Or tea leaves or whatever sort of prognosticating tool you want. Get a groundhog. I don't care. Come on over, and we would love to hear from you. panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Alan Chartok, Jennifer Merz, Libby Post, and Sarah Rogerson are all here. We welcome your letters. panel@wamc.org. We'll continue after this news from the BBC. All right. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. And we have a wonderful panel this morning. Alan Chartok, Jennifer Burns, Libby Post, and Sarah Rogerson. So let us look into the crystal balls, or again, whatever prognosticating method you wish to use. The question is what happens here, and to play it out. So let's say that the governor stays put, does not continues to say, I'm not resigning, and then the investigation does find that there was that there were things of great concern there. Then what happens? Then where do we go from there? And meanwhile, while all of this is happening, there still is an impeachment investigation going on. So, Alan, do you want to start that?
Well, I will. I think what will happen here is that he, first of all, my crystal ball is not even foggy on this. He will not resign unless, of course, a size 17 shoe falls and it really does.
Well, what would that be? I mean,
I don't know.
You got a lot of 15s and 14s that have already fallen.
Yeah, well, maybe 12s and 11s. But I think it would have to be a major thing. Usually, the shoe size would have something to do with something criminal. See, the stuff that he's been accused of now is not really criminal. It's
well, sexual assault would be criminal
if he did sexual assault. Do you think? Well, my sense of it is that that has yet to be announced, and so far he's on fairly safe grounds until somebody says he really sexually assaulted me. And if they do, and they're willing to come forward and give their names, because in this country you're supposed to have, you know, you're supposed to be confronted by your accuser, then I think it would be very bad, Joe, very bad for him. And that's what I'm talking about. But otherwise, I think he stays right where he is. And I would not be one bit surprised to see him have the massive ego needed to run for office a second time. A fourth time.
Yeah. Libby Post.
Well, I agree with Alan. I do think he's going to stay regardless until there's, you know, a criminal charge. Or something comes out in the investigations that makes it untenable for him to be able to stay. But really, the fact is, though, is that, you know, politically, we've got Jay Jacobs taking the temperature of all the county chairs. And we have to see what that's going to be like and what happens on a county level. And then you've got, you know, almost the entire congressional delegation, including our two senators, calling on him to step down. And so, you know, politically, it's going to be difficult, but that has never stopped him in the past. So, you know, he probably won't step down, but that doesn't mean he shouldn't step down.
Yeah. And so we have the investigation, obviously, that's taking place from the Attorney General of the state of New York. And then you also have the separate investigation into impeachment, of which the state assembly has taken up. So
and I think we have to wait for those investigations. I really do. You know, a rush to judgment here isn't going to do anybody any good. And we have to think of it. The long-term health of the state and the Democratic Party and what we're trying to get done nationally. So I think due process needs to be the order of the day.
Sarah Rogerson, how's your crystal ball looking these days?
Oh, shattered and broken. I'm the idealist on the panel usually, right? And I would like for this to be a moment of for our Democratic Party to really put its money where its mouth is on issues involving sexual assault or even just inappropriate workplace harassment, which it's, you know, some of the majority of the claims seem to be. And I'm not saying just to minimize the effect of that. I mean, I would wager good money that every woman on this panel has been subjected to harassment by men in power. And we don't have to live that way anymore. And I trust the future of the Democratic Party in the hands of Kathy Hochul. I would like to rally behind her as a leader and many other leaders who are developing and waiting in the wings and have been working hard for the state of New York. And if the governor's concerned about preserving his legacy, he's got a lot to stand on there. I would like, it's concerning that you have county executives making anonymous statements because they're afraid. You have a congressional delegation, coordinating their statements to be within minutes in order to, I think the story said, and I can't remember if it was a quote or not, that he can't kill us all at once.
Right.
What is that? That is not the Democratic Party that I want to be a part of. I want to be a part of the Democratic Party that supports women running for office because they know that we'll be good leaders and are good leaders in our community. I want to see a Democratic Party that sees a future free of workplace harassment, sexual assault at the highest level. And so I don't you know, there's a lot. I also believe in the rule of law, but from a norms perspective, like where we want the party to go and what it should do for New York State. I'd really like for the people who have the governor's ear to be as vocal as possible about that, although it sounds like it's impossible to be vocal.
Well, or they're being vocal and it's just being ignored. It's being rebuffed.
So also possible.
To your point, though, which I find fascinating, if you know, if we look at this and this fear of retribution, I mean, we even see that in some of the statements regarding this Larry Schwartz story and county executives saying, you know, we're not even going to give our names because we're so worried that we're not going to then get the vaccine. I mean, if that's still an issue, you know, if that's very much an issue, then that's concerning in and of itself. But I wonder, and I want to get, before I add questions to the docket, I want to get Jennifer's thoughts on the original question. But I would also like to add this idea of, does the, at this state and given the damage, does the governor still have that, for want of a better term, bullying power that he had prior to these allegations? Jennifer Burns.
If I use my crystal ball, I don't think Cuomo is going to resign or go anywhere. And I actually think what he's doing is setting up his way to complicate, maybe not purposefully, or it probably is purposefully because it's political, the investigations that are going on, because he's speaking for himself a lot. And his recent statements have all been that, you know, we have to separate the facts from opinions. And look at the allegations that are, you know, the motivation behind the allegations. So he's really flipping the script here. He's also saying that, or implying that his coworkers won't work with him. So he's being canceled. So he's not the one at fault if things aren't working well. It's them. They are bullying or they are coming together against him. And I think that's where he's headed. I don't think he's resigning. And I think he's pumping these investigations so that the water will be muddy and he'll be able to defend himself against them. But I think the investigations need to go forward because, one, it's the way the law should work. And two, because we're losing sight of the women. And these investigations need to happen so that what women in the workplace are experiencing is documented and reported and defended, and they don't experience the retribution elsewhere for the rest of their careers for coming out when they are mistreated in the workplace, because that's what's going to happen. We're spending a lot of time talking about Cuomo, but what about these women?
Libby, anything you'd like to add to that?
No, I mean, I think Jennifer's point is really well taken. It's, you know, this is like this classic model of barreling through regardless at the expense of in this point, women, but at the expense of people who have come forward. And it's not a political model specific to Cuomo, but it is a political model that we see played over and over and over again. The more press time that you can take up, the more oxygen you can take up in the room, the less there is for the folks who have come forward.
Alan, we'll put aside our crystal balls, you know, one of the things that I'm curious about here is this idea of where we go once this investigation happens of the long game. And again, if the attorney general says, okay, these are very concerning, serious charges, and this is what we found, then what? Are we right back to where we were, right where we are now?
I was going to say that we're right back to where we are now. I mean, it is clear if he steps aside in some way, he is assumed to be guilty of something. He knows that. And his political career is dead. If he stays where he is, this is not an endorsement from me. And by the way, Joe, I think a lot of people should do their homework and go back and look at what I was writing for the first two terms that Cuomo was the governor. It was very hard stuff, and he didn't like it, and I know because I got all those phone calls. So this idea that somehow we, WAMC, are too connected to the governor is just ridiculous. But what do I think is going to happen? I think he's going to stay because he thinks he has to. It's the only way his political career doesn't get dead, and I suspect that he may even surprise a few people by running. And then the big question is going to be, who you got? Who are you going to put up against them? Both the Republicans. I mean, I know some Republicans I'd love to see run for governor, like Chris Gibson right now, or some of the people who wanted to when the Republican bums, you know, wouldn't let them and then just ran themselves. So I'm thinking that he's just going to stick with this program unless, as I have said, somebody comes out and says this is criminal. And the attorney general's people, the two super legal stars that she's chosen, will in fact make the difference.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we have a lot of letters on this, so we'll go to those. We welcome yours. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Let's go to some letters this morning, and that'll bring us up to the top of the hour. One second here. I just have to. We go to Jeremy, who says, it should be noted that President Biden faced very similar accusations to Governor Cuomo during the presidential primary. This could explain his appreciation for due process. Strange to see Democrats like Schumer call for his resignation while singing the praises of President Biden's achievements. All right, let's go to, I mean, is there something to be said? I'm just asking this as a political question, Alan, but is there something to be said for the concerns of a senator in a state versus that of a national politician like the president of the United States?
Well, it's clear that the political establishment, Joe, in New York State wants Cuomo out of here. And we know why. Cuomo has been not nice to people. And that's a big part of it. And so you reap what you sow, and he is. Lawrence writes to us, I've talked to a number of different people, including women, who are undeniably of a strong feminist orientation, have no great love of Cuomo, yet feel this cancel culture of guilt based on public opinion and accusation is outrageous and, yes, un-American. Cuomo may well be a bully and an arrogant, boorish man, but he should have a fair hearing, as we have come to expect in this country, and that's from Lawrence.
Is that the one you sent?
Yes.
Okay, so let me have to take that out of my queue. Okay.
Oh, did I write it? No.
No. But you sent it. You sent it, and yeah. So then you. I'm just
well worth
making
reading.
Sure I had it. Yeah. Not in my queue. Okay. Rob says Governor Cuomo's ability to govern is not compromised by his investigation. This investigation, he will need to answer some questions, but the investigation is out of his hands, as it should be. He promised to serve New York as long as we will have him. Keeping that promise is his greatest privilege and responsibility. I would suggest that he seeks therapy, even if he doesn't think he needs it, because it will help him to better understand how to better conduct himself in the future. Plus, it will look good.
Well, you know, okay. Character, as Freud said, character is a big part of all of this. And even if he has therapy, and many people have in this country for real good results, sometimes it will make a difference in the formation of your character. Look, he was a bully when he worked for Mario. There's no question about it. And he certainly has those tendencies right now. Hard to believe that you can snap your fingers and make a change.
All right. Let's go to Diane. Well, go ahead.
I think the other question, Jennifer, here is, can he govern if no one will work with him? Right, because he's claiming or kind of saying that, and this call from Swartz also indicates that he is not, people are not working with him. They don't want to be around him. They're trying to stay as far from phone calls from him or his buddies or people who speak for him. Melissa DeRosa apparently is not calling or talking to anybody, or they're not taking her calls. She's not speaking up. So can he govern if people won't work with him? That's the real question.
Well, Jennifer, do they have any choice? I mean, they got to pass a budget, right? So
They're working with his people. That's for sure. His budget negotiations are ongoing. And so they're working with the point people on the second floor to get the budget done, because both sides, everybody knows, regardless of all of this, that the budget needs to be done because it has a real impact on the people of New York State if the budget isn't passed on time. We've seen that in the past. So that is going on. And I'm sure all three leaders will take total credit for it being done, and that's part of politics, and it's just the way it goes. But moving into the future, it'll be interesting to see how things are done. You know, this governor has a propensity to put policy into the budget. Some of that has been, all of that has been taken out in the Assembly One House bills, and so it'll be interesting to see how all that plays out. But marijuana is going to get settled. Sports betting is going to get settled. Some of the big ticket items for revenue will get settled in this budget. And then we'll move forward from there.
And won't the governor get the credit, Libby?
Well, I think all three of them will take credit.
They can take credit. But the way that it usually works is if something happens, the governor gets the credit. That's the political history of New York State.
Yeah. I mean, he'll get credit. They'll all get credit. I mean, you know, it's all according whose press release you're reading and what the individual media, who the individual media wants to call out.
You know, Libby.
You know, social media, each one will take credit for getting the budget passed.
You know,
that's
Libby,
okay. That's the way it works.
You know, Libby, I've often said somebody should stand out in front of the legislature, the home of the legislature, and ask the first 20 people who pass, what's the name of the speaker? And I'd be surprised if you get more than two or three who know it. So they can claim the credit, but, you know, the governor is the guy with his face out there who always gets the credit.
Yeah, okay. That's great. You know, that's the way it works. And I don't think that really has much of an impact in all of this.
I don't know, though, if people across the state are going to agree with that because of what's going on with the multiple allegations and scandals of bullying everywhere, or if people are really going to start to hone in on their elected officials locally and the state assemblymen, and they're going to say they did this. Yes, he has to sign off and all of that, but they were able to do this without him.
And you think they'll know their names? You think they'll know the name of Speaker Carl Hastie?
I don't know if that matters so much. It'll be that Cuomo was outside of it. We got it done without him. I think many people are going to consider that, because it's not just the sexual harassment charges. It's the COVID vaccines now that are involved. It's the nursing home allegations and that investigation. It's all these other things. And I do think it will shift some of the focus for people away from him and giving him credit, because they're going to say we did this without him as the leading force in it.
What's,
and I think it's not necessarily that it's Hastie or Stuart Cousins. It's the Assembly and the Senate. Mm-hmm. They got it done.
Yep.
Let's see. We have this letter from Kimberly. How about forcing him to take anger management and sensitivity courses and allow his accusers to give voice within the legal process? We have this from Alyssa, who says, stop saying sexual assault. Cuomo is not accused of sexual assault. He is accused of harassment. You are not doing a service to women, feminism, and defining workplace harassment by lumping the two together in this case. Correct me if I am wrong, panel, but the allegation at the governor's mansion is sexual assault, correct?
That's right. Anything, the unwanted physical touching is sexual assault, including the kiss. in the office on the second
floor. So, I mean, we are right in saying both sexual harassment and sexual assault allegations. Okay, let's see. Sonia says, if Trump could stay in his place despite all the despicable things he was accused of, Cuomo should absolutely stay in office. Is that a two wrongs don't make a right, Alan?
Otherwise known as false equivalency.
Yeah, all right.
No, well. I mean, you know, I get that. And I live with somebody who makes that point, that the despicable things that Trump has been doing all along are... you know, outrageous, that Trump did all along, were outrageous, grabbing people by their private parts and doing all of that stuff. And we all know that, and we all know he got away with it. And he didn't get elected, but he got away with it. Nobody raised the standards of the voices that ought to have been raised there. But you have to judge each case on their own, and you can't say because somebody else did it, it's okay in this case.
And Sonia goes on to say, I'm so sick of the circular firing squad when a Democrat is involved while the crooked Republicans just slide through with a complete GOP support. We needed Cuomo's leadership to deal with the bully in chief to get us out of the pandemic abyss in New York State. I would absolutely vote for him if he runs for governor again. We will have a poll, by the way. There's a new poll expected from Siena coming out on the governor's approval rating.
Is that
I
today,
believe,
Joe?
11 o'clock. Yep, great. 11 o'clock. So Diane says Cuomo should neither resign nor step away. He might take a few days off, maybe ask his mother and his daughters for advice. But if we remember Bill Clinton, he did not resign even under a full federal impeachment. Five, or is it now six, women have come forward to disclose the governor's inappropriate actions and suggestions. There will be a full investigation, and we should wait for the information to come as a result. Meanwhile, Governor Cuomo should not act like an idiot and send his henchmen out to see who remains friendly.
And by the way, henchman is not an inappropriate term here.
Let's see. One more, and then we'll take a break. Jay says, what are the chances Cuomo didn't know what his dunce was doing? This, I believe the said dunce here would be Larry Schwartz, was doing that, and that COVID numbers were being hidden. Oh, no, I guess he's talking about the nursing home case.
AYK. Are you kidding?
All right. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we will continue. We welcome your letters. panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We will be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us. Alan Chartok, Jennifer Burns, Libby Post, Sarah Rogerson, all making up the panel. We welcome your letters. panel@wamc.org. We do have some letters that I want to get to here before we move on to other topics. Emily says, I'm listening to your discussion about Governor Cuomo this morning and felt compelled to write. This is absolutely a women's issue, which we know is a human rights issue. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand was harshly criticized for her call for fellow Democratic Senator Al Franken to step down when he faced allegations. This stance arguably had an impact on her campaign for U.S. presidency. Fast forward, where is the praise for Senator Gillibrand today? She has clearly demonstrated a strong stance on this issue, a stance that is not deterred by party lines. Anyone on that? Libby?
I couldn't agree more.
Okay. Sarah.
Spot on.
Thank you.
Sarah.
I assume you agree, Libby.
Sure.
Okay. No, I'm actually not sure because you said that, but that's okay. We go to Donna, who says, under what legal basis would Cuomo temporarily turn the governor's position over to Hochul? Does the New York State Constitution provide for situations like this? Wouldn't he have to actually leave office for her to be appointed? Who knows the New York State Constitution? Anyone?
Well, actually, my colleague Bennett Liebman at Albany Law School does, and he had a Twitter thread this weekend that I believe sums up perhaps a white paper that he's written on the subject or research he's done in the past. I meant to locate any publications that he's put out there. If they have been, they'd be on the Government Law Center website at Albany Law. But it does not, there does not seem to be a provision in the Constitution that has ever been enacted, proposed, but not enacted, that would provide a mechanism for removal from office.
But say, what happens if the governor any governor, and then there's a lieutenant governor. What happens if the governor has a stroke and is incapacitated? One would think that the lieutenant governor would take over the day-to-day operations.
From what I gleaned, there was a provision that was proposed about incapacitation, and it was stricken. And I think because they couldn't agree on what would constitute incapacitation.
I kind of get that now.
Probably they were all in the room and said, yeah, what could happen? Yeah, like what, you know. It's not like he's going to dot, dot, dot. Jack says, vaccinations aside, why are maskless states like Florida having COVID rates no higher than strict lockdown states like California? Well, that wasn't okay. Anybody?
Well, there
I don't know that that's true. Is that
first of all, I don't know if it's true. Second of all, there is something called stupidity. A lot of people walk around in certain states and they don't wear masks and they're dumb. And they put themselves at great risk. So, you know, you'd have to know the stats on how much compliance there is with Dr. Fauci and wearing a mask, for example.
Yeah, I don't know the, I'm not sure on the exactly what the question is asking. But anyway, we'll go to Kathleen, who says, why would the legislature not impeach him? He is utterly toxic at this point. Prakash says, Governor Cuomo is an elected official. He has given his side of explanation of controversy surrounding him. He should not resign unless found guilty by the special investigation team. The voters of New York State should decide his fate in the next election. If he resigns prematurely, character assassination may become a day-to-day affair that will discourage intelligent people from entering politics.
Well, Joe, that's an interesting one. He shouldn't resign unless the two investigators who've been hired, the legal eagles, find something. Well, they're not a court either, right? Am I wrong about that?
No. Right.
You know what's really interesting, though, about this is that women elected officials have are far less likely to be accused of these types of accusations. And I think it's far greater that people who are likely to commit these types of offenses should be chilled from running for office. And those who would never do such things in the workplace will be empowered to run for office because they can start climbing the ladder that puts them in a position to assume the governorship without fear of being harassed in the workplace, right? I am far less concerned about men who behave inappropriately being chilled from running from office than I am that women, young women in particular, think about girls in New York State right now who are looking and saying, why haven't we had a woman governor in the state yet?
So what are you proposing?
And what this message sends to them.
So what are you proposing?
I am proposing that we stop focusing on the perpetrators and think more about women and girls in the state, how we support them, how we develop them, and how we empower them.
Well, that's great. But I thought implicit.
I think you're responding to the part of the letter saying that this would shield men who wanted to run for office in the future, right? Is that what you're responding to? Yeah.
Yeah. And not enough attention is paid to that piece. And so, you know, it's a little bit different than where you were going, Alan, but I think it's important to lift up.
Okay, I'm just not sure. I'm not trying to be clever here because I'm not. but I'm just asking you what it is, whether what you're recommending is a preventative measure about men running for political office. It sounded that way.
No, I'm not.
That would be ludicrous. What I'm saying is if we're worried about chilling effects of investigations and accusations and attention paid to this, the chilling effect that I'm more concerned about is the chilling effect on women and girls who see this and say,
I see.
I don't want to be involved in government.
I got it.
All right. Let's see. I think let's move on to other subjects here if we can. And we'll go to let's go to the Mexican border and the headline in today's New York Times on Mexico's border with U.S. desperation as migrant traffic piles up. Mexico is struggling to deal with a new wave of migrants expelled from the U.S., while even more come north hoping to cross. Shelters that were empty 4 months ago are now having to turn many away. Sarah, this is your work. So give us a sense of the situation and what we know. I will say in this article in the New York Times, the United States is expelling them back to Mexico, where they wait along with tens of thousands of others hoping to cross. The pressure and desperation is quickly building among families stuck in Mexico as shelters and officials struggle to help them. Meanwhile, federal authorities are scrambling to manage a sharp increase in children who are crossing the border on their own and then being held in detention facilities. So what needs to be done immediately and what needs to be done over the long term, Sarah?
And if you were Biden, what would you be thinking right now?
Other good question.
So I speak from expertise in immigration policy, which Joe Biden is not. He has a lot of really great people working for him, but he's in a different position, right? So like in the political position, politics screws everything up. You've got Republicans coming out and saying, you know, now that Biden's president, and because he's opening our borders, now we have a rush of people at the border, which is just not true. It's the same old thing they say every single time. I mean, my first time speaking to local news outlets on this subject was in 2013. And every year, there's migration patterns are predictable. There are push-pull factors. It gets politicized because it's a federal issue. What I would do in the short term is what most immigration experts agree on, especially immigration experts who have studied the laws involving detention of children, which is bring them in. There is no political line that says we're opposed to sheltering children who are fleeing forced gang membership, human trafficking, starvation. And like, these are kids, and they come when they believe that they can live a better life, when their parents send them, separate from them in order to give their children a chance at a life, period, not just a better life, but a life, period.
So Sarah,
and we miss all of that in this noise about rushes and panic and whatever. Just let them in.
So are you saying that every child who wants to come in should come in?
Every child who is presenting as an unaccompanied child should be processed through the border and in a child-centered way, placed with appropriate caregivers. That's the way it's supposed to work. Under the Obama administration, families presenting at the border will be provided with a caseworker. And under this program, the vast majority, over 90%, I think it's over 92%, of individuals who were then brought before an immigration judge to plead their case showed up to court because they had appropriate supports. We've got a bill pending in New York State that would provide mandatory attorneys, counsel, to immigrants who are facing removal proceedings. That's the fancy term for going to immigration court. And we know that people who show up with lawyers, not only are they more likely to avail themselves of the court process, they're more likely to win their case. So, you know, we've got a lot of bona fide claims of people who have not been allowed in this country. We've shut down our borders in a historically unprecedented move based on false science and against the recommendations of other federal bureaus. And that was Mike Pence who did that. It's just, I wish everybody could be an immigration expert. I wish everybody could go to the border and see what really happens. I wish everybody could and everybody does, whether you know it or not, you're talking to immigrants every day of your life, right. Especially in New York State. Immigrants created the viruses that are helping us all be healthy again. Immigrants power this country. And I really get frustrated with the media and even reputable news outlets, and even reputable news outlets who do great job reporting on immigration. But I'm representing, our clinic is representing people who were stuck in the migrant protection protocol and who were recently permitted to come into the United States. And these are people with real asylum claims based on international and domestic law who have been sitting in refugee camps created by our federal government for over a year.
So
that created a humanitarian crisis.
So I realize that, I mean, you addressed this, but I just want to clarify. As it stands right now, are there things that this administration is currently doing that are wrong, that should be changed immediately, that could help this situation of what we're seeing?
Well, it looks like they're working on it. So as of last night, I saw that some kids had been held for 5 days in temporary facilities, and it's supposed to be no more than 72 hours. There's an agreement called the Flores Settlement Agreement that sets forth the conditions under which our government can detain children and what's supposed to happen. We have all these laws in place through the Office for Refugee Resettlement specific to unaccompanied minors that places them in more child centered facilities. That's the system we have. We can do better and we should do better. And not only are we stuck with the system we have, but we're stuck a little bit with the system that we have that Trump and Stephen Miller made more punishing and more inhumane. And the Biden administration has done a lot of things. They've emptied, they've cleared out the detention, some of the worst detention facilities, and have released families who have been in family detention. There are signs and signals that family detention may be at an end, which is great. Getting away from private detention facilities, all these good moves. It's just they can't move fast enough
right.
to undo the gravity of damage that was done under the Trump administration. It cannot be overstated how terrible that was.
So this morning, as we read headlines that the Biden administration is directing FEMA to help shelter migrant children, is that how much of a Band-Aid is that? And is it, I mean, is it substantial, or how should we read it, I guess, is ultimately the question I'm asking.
Well, it's a sign that some of the protections and supports for unaccompanied minors were stripped out under Trump, and they can't be scaled up fast enough. So an emergency management system is being deployed. I hope that emergency management protocol includes child-sensitive and trauma-sensitive care, as opposed to just, you know, treating it sort of like a disaster, which it's not. This is pretty average in terms of migration flows. So I wouldn't read too much into it other than that the Biden administration is trying to provide a humanitarian response instead of a military response. And that's a huge shift and a positive one.
Sarah, we've talked before on this program about this, but for people who are just tuning in and maybe even tuning into this issue, given the change in circumstances, could you just talk a little bit, and this goes back to the introduction about the Immigration Law Clinic, but how this affects us here in this region, of how you see the effects, of how we see the effects. As you mentioned, we talk to immigrants every single day, but when it comes to these issues of how they impact us and impact us in this community.
I talk a lot with farmers who for the last 4 years have said that their workforce is terrified, who have been scrambling to provide employment security beyond pay and benefits and try to get people assistance with their immigration, you know, to travel through this broken immigration system. I hear a lot from churches and faith-based groups who are frustrated that they have seen the vibrant migrant communities that they have lived and worked and played and worshiped with get locked up and tossed out of the country. In this region, I think we value and appreciate most of us. There are, of course, some who don't, including Rensselaer County currently, which has the only 287G agreement in the entire state of New York that allows local law enforcement to cooperate with ICE. And there's a bill pending in the State House that would eliminate any local police cooperation with Immigration Customs Enforcement, which is a good move. But New York has a special relationship with immigrants because, you know, unless you're Native American, all New Yorkers have migrated from somewhere or have parents or grandparents who migrated from somewhere else to be here. So in this region, I hear a lot of care and concern to make sure that potential New Yorkers, as I like to call them, we have one of our clients who was stuck in the migrant protection protocol is resettled in a nice two-family home in Brooklyn and thriving, doing well, food on the table. And that's the New York that I see every day.
Libby?
You know, my son is a farmer. And when Sarah was talking about talking to farmers, it's been tough getting the help that they need to be able to do the, you know, to harvest and bring food to market, which impacts all of us. I mean, there's no two ways about it. It impacts all of us. If fields are left to fallow and food is left to rot, then we don't get to eat. And, you know, the small-mindedness of the Trump administration regarding this, and it was all about creating a white country for them. It had nothing to do with making sure people ate, that's for sure. You know, it has impacted the small farms. And even, I'm sure, some of the bigger farms. But my son's an organic farmer, and it has impacted his ability to get, you know, food to table. And it's got to stop. And what we see over in Rensselaer County has to stop as well. We have to stop thinking of immigration as illegal people, as these folks as illegal. I mean, I read the story this morning. It was heartbreaking that there was a woman and her daughter that was stopped at the border, and she had to call her husband, who's already in Chicago, right? And that she couldn't cross over. You know, there needs to be some type of reunification in all of this. But I also think, and I go back to what Sarah was saying, is that the numbers aren't all that different. I think that the media, you know, the honeymoon period for the Biden administration didn't even last 100 days. And so they're looking for stuff to show that's negative. And I think that that's really unfortunate for the administration, but also for the media, in a sense that this is the focus. You know, after 4 years of Trump, and some of them being responsible for putting him in office, now it's about, you know, showing the shortcomings of the Biden administration, not giving this administration the chance that they need. Now, I know that the Biden administration is going to do their work regardless, and they're going to make a big difference, and this will get cleaned up, and other things will get cleaned up. But they're cleaning up 4 years of immigration mess that came on top of decades of immigration mess, but were not as mean and nasty and disgusting. So,
Jennifer,
it's going to take a little while.
Jennifer, we have about 2 minutes.
I'm always struggling with which is the more powerful system at work here. Is it xenophobic or is it racist? And obviously they are intersecting and intertwining in this issue. But it's so difficult to also consider when immigrants are coming in that we frequently just associate them with farm working. And I know that historically that has been you know, a role that they have filled. But it scares me because it sets up a new, it perpetuates a continued stereotype. Because although that may be a foot in the door, that's not necessarily what immigrants who are coming to America want to do forever. And so when we're looking at, you know, by the COVID relief plan right now and how that's going to aid farmers, I think it's really important that we get this, get immigration adjusted and really solidify that people coming in may need this to start, and our farmers in America need it. But also we want immigrants who come into this country to be able to excel and bring all of their gifts and go beyond just being what we've stereotyped and pigeonholed them into, which is the kind of farm workers for other people. So I'm always struggling with this. And sometimes I wonder, you know, how do we keep track, and this is a Sarah question, of what are the grounds that allow people in and what are the policies that are expelling them? What are those criteria?
We need to take a break. So Sarah, hold on to that question. We'll get an answer right after this. Listening to the music of Christopher Theofanides, who the name of the composition is Concerto for Viola and Chamber Orchestra, and David Allen Miller is the maestro, along with the Albany Symphony Orchestra, winners of a Grammy last night. And David will be with us in our 11 o'clock hour. We have our entire playlist on our website, wamc.org/roundtable, and you can go there. Wonderful panel taking place this morning. We welcome you to join us. Panel at wamc.org, Alan Chartok, Jennifer Burns, Libby Post, and Sarah Rogerson. When last we talked, Jennifer posed a question to Sarah. And Sarah, if you could just re-clarify the question, repose the question, and then answer it, we'll be in good shape.
Yeah, I think, Jennifer, correct me if I'm wrong, but you were wondering about the policies that lead to the expulsion of families from the interior of the United States. Right.
So the difference between a refugee and an immigrant, just someone who wants to move to America, but then also what is the criteria for allowing them in or expelling them? What can determine that? What rules?
Yeah, so tons of them. And primarily we're talking about the immigration code. So that's a federal code. This is where we get into administrative law. They're implementing regulations in the Code of Federal Regulations that are enforced by various executive branches, right? So the Department of Justice, the Department of Homeland Security, the Executive Office for Immigration Review, which is the judges. But those are also located in the Department of Justice, which is a quirk of immigration law that is messed up, but not the point of the question. So when you're talking about refugees, you also have international human rights law. And there's a difference between a refugee and an asylee. A refugee has advanced permission to enter the country. An asylee is someone who presents themselves at the border or the interior and expresses a credible fear of returning to their home country on account of political opinion, membership in a social group, ethnicity, religion, a number of different protected grounds. There are ways that people can be immediately expelled once they cross the border. That's where you hear people being, quote unquote, turned away. Sometimes that's a process done by Customs and Border Protection. Sometimes it's a process called expedited removal, where somebody gets removed without even seeing a judge. There are lots and lots of different ways that we have to keep people from coming in or to force them to leave once they've entered. Our asylum protections have been slowly eroded almost to extinction under the Trump administration, and the Biden administration is trying to piece them back together again. And then there's lots of other sneaky things. Another thing that happened over the weekend that didn't make the top five news in most places, but is really important, is the overturning of the public charge rule that the Trump administration enforced to exclude people from being able to access immigration, permanent immigration status, if they were likely to become a public charge or a ward of the state or dependent on state benefits. And that was deeply problematic. And I think maybe the most important thing to recognize is that all of our laws on immigration are based on racist policies that date back to the early 20th century. The ones that are the negative, well, pretty much actually all of them, because even the laws granting status do so based on caps imposed by country of origin, which is something that this Congress is hoping to change. So there's a lot there. There's a lot to unpack. And there are lots of different ways that the government seeks to control migration flows and prevent people from entering. And there a new way, a better way is possible, a more humane way is possible. And I just really hope that Americans haven't bought into the rhetoric from the last 4 years, because if so, the hill will be steeper and higher to climb to get out.
All right. We have some questions from listeners on this immigration point, and then we'll move on to our final topic for this morning. Casey writes, politicians use the buzz phrase comprehensive immigration reform, but have little understanding of the legal immigration process and just how broken it is. Make the legal process easier and streamline. More citizens means more taxpayers and productive members of society. We go to Mark, who says, what can and can't Biden do, either by executive order or by other means, to help the thousands of unaccompanied children at our border? Can he declare a disaster, or did Governor Abbott have to? Is Governor Abbott helping or hurting Biden's efforts? Sarah.
We already have laws on the books to assist unaccompanied minors. The state governors can't do anything about it. They're laws that shield unaccompanied minors and actually provide pathways to citizenship for some of them, including and particularly special immigrant juveniles, which our clinic has represented for years and years. And those are kids who have been abused, abandoned, or neglected by one or both of their parents. There are other protections for other unaccompanied minors, and we do already have laws on the books. I don't imagine that Governor Abbott, well, actually, I'm not sure. In Texas, it's immigration makes for strange bedfellows. you see Ted Cruz saying what looks like sympathetic things about immigrants and then voting in ways that are not supportive. So Texas is complicated. I practiced immigration law there for about 2.5 years under the Bush administration, which was super interesting. But there are a lot of things that Biden can do by executive order. But the more permanent, lasting, and helpful things are what Congress is doing right now in terms of changing the code to make it more streamlined and more helpful, but not only for unaccompanied minors, but for families and anyone seeking to enter our country.
And one more letter, and then we'll go to our final topic. Shoba says, How is it that Mexico allows people from Central America to simply enter the country on its southern border and travel through Mexico to reach the U.S. border? Also, are we to classify everyone who suffers abuse or being recruited into gangs as asylum seekers? If that was the case, nearly half the world would qualify for asylum. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, there's a provision in our asylum laws that has to say that the government is unwilling or unable, the government of your home country is unwilling or unable to protect you from those forces operating in your country. So it's not any victim of gang violence or any victim of domestic violence, although I think our country has a lot of great protections for people who can actually make it up here. I think we're oversimplifying the journey that immigrants make when they travel on foot through our southern border. It's not as easy as what you are imagining potentially when you're reading these news stories once they're already here. It's a long, arduous journey that all of the clients that I've worked with spent many months preparing for and contemplating before making the difficult decision to leave a country that they love and care about in order to protect themselves from forces that their government will not protect them from. With regard to Mexico's immigration policies, it's complicated. There's a lot that I could say about all of that, but the bottom line is that Mexico's government is not well equipped to handle the situation unfolding in Central America and the resulting migration. So this is the push-pull factors, right? People are largely migrating to Mexico in order to come to the United States, which puts Mexico in a very difficult position, being under-resourced as well to regulate migration flows. But I don't think we should be talking as much about borders. This can get really philosophical, and I won't go there. But I think anytime you're thinking about a border, you should think about why it's there and what it means, in opposition to some of the stories that are coming out in the media about the people who are seeking protection in our country. The whole argument about, won't we just have opening our doors to hundreds of thousands of people just don't ring true. Canada has one of the most liberal immigration policies. They provide lawyers to immigrants seeking safety in their country, and they have not experienced that sort of like floodgates argument that people are often raising. And our northern border is far less policed than our southern border. So I just want to put that out there for folks to think about.
Well, thank you, Sarah. I want to just end with this story in regards to another issue that the Biden administration is dealing with, and that, of course, is opening schools. It was one of his first proposals by the new White House to tackle what President Biden has said is a central goal of his administration, promoting racial equity through federal policy. The idea, a competitive grant program for schools that would give the federal government a more central role in combating longstanding educational disparities. It's the cat. Oh, the cat's in the room. A more central role in combating longstanding educational disparities that have been worsened by the pandemic. But as Biden signed a coronavirus relief bill into law Thursday, his proposed COVID-19 Educational Equity Gap Challenge grant was missing from the $130 billion allocated for schools, the result of pushback from advocates who warned it would have the opposite of its intended effect. So, Alan, what do you do?
Well, I do think I want to pass on this one to Libby because she makes so much sense. Libby?
Excuse me?
What do you mean, excuse me?
I make so much sense?
Yeah, I pass to you, and you usually have a very good perspective on things, and I thought I'd pass to you, like a good basketball player.
You.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I think this is between a rock and a hard place. And, you talked about Ted Cruz before saying nice things about immigrants. He was, bashing the Biden administration for not doing enough and for equity in education, like he could care about that at all. I think the notion of equity this is not going to be easy. This is not going to be a one-time fix. We're dealing with structural racism and how schools are funded. Schools are funded through property taxes. And so, yeah, white schools have more property taxes because it's just the facts of life in terms of where people are living, the history of redlining in our country, how that has kept people of color from living in middle-class suburban neighborhoods. And so if property taxes is going to be the basis of your school taxes, there's going to be inequity. That's the underlying part of all of this. And then you have the school reopening on top of that, where there's not the money because of the equity issues to begin with. And I think the Biden administration wants to try to level the playing field, but education is it's like the third rail, just like senior citizens.
Absolutely.
And so you have you walk a very fine tightrope. But something does need to be done because kids have lost a full year of learning. And for those kids in good school districts, whose parents have the wherewithal and the ability and the money to be engaged in their kids' education, I think it can be overcome. In poor school districts where parents have to work three jobs to put food on the table and they can't be as engaged in their kids' education, it's going to be harder to overcome.
Jennifer, any thoughts in a minute and 12 seconds?
Well, I would say, you know, this just creates competition in the school administrations who, if, you know, have to apply for a grant, because you're putting it on the teachers and those schools to apply. And writing grants and applying for grants is a challenge as it is. And if you are already struggling with money, you're looking at having to fix your buildings, you're dealing with the social distancing and health care and all of these other issues, you really don't have the time, especially if schools are overcrowded in general, to apply for these things. And so that too is going to compound to the fact that you are not going to receive this grant if this proposal was to go through, because you don't have the time, the ability to apply for it. So, you know, I think it's creating undue competition again.
We're going to end there. And I thank you all for your thoughtful responses this morning. Thanks to everybody who wrote in. Alan, thank you. Good to see you.
Good, you too.
Jennifer, Libby, and Sarah, thank you. We will be back right after this.